Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your host for this weekend show, also your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com. And podcast, use your podcast player, just search the KE Report, and also on Substack and YouTube, also the KE Report. That's where you can find all of our daily editorials and company updates from throughout the week. On this weekend show, we're going to at least start off focusing on the metal sector. We'll touch on silver, but we talk so much about silver during the week that it's not going to be a huge focus on this weekend show. But there are other things to talk about in a couple other metals areas that I think deserve some attention that might be getting overlooked. And on the back half of the show, more looking broadly at these markets and how they're looking to end the year. Kicking off this show with Brian Lenny. Brian is the founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review. And Brian, let's start with silver. As I said, we don't want to spend too much time on silver, but silver has just been on an absolute tear. It's exploded higher ever since it broke that $50 level, consolidated very quickly above there, and then just kept taking off even to start this month. A lot of people are saying you just got to plow into silver stocks. It makes every silver stock profitable, and there just aren't that many pure play silver stocks. What do you think about silver's run here, Brian?
First, thanks for having me on, guys. For me, maybe I'm the Debbie Downer of the metals bullish talk. I'm a bottom-up investor, and so I invest exclusively in the equities for profit. And while the metal price is certainly important, I don't try to get too wrapped up into where I think the metal price is headed. You know, that said, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm bearish on silver. I certainly think that it has all of the components for something that's going to go up in the future. But I think, you know, looking across the market, looking at how many people are sort of participating in the bullish pump or the bullish sentiment surrounding the silver price and where it might be headed. To me, I think investors need to be aware of kind of the environment you're in and how that might be affecting where the silver price is going. Second to that, you know, metal price is just one way that you can be wrong about a junior mining company. There's so many ways that you can lose money outside of being right or wrong about the metal price. And so I would say there's some caution with just, you know, taking a bullish silver thesis and applying it to a junior mining company. I think you want to look at the fundamentals of that company, look for the reasons outside of the metal price of why that share price is going to go up, and sort of invest or speculate accordingly. And to me, over time, that's going to be the best way for you to make money and keep the money that you've made. The biggest mistakes I've made probably in my speculation career are based around, you know, buying things because I thought I knew where a metal price was headed. And I certainly learned from that and learned from that the hard way. But again, you know, I like the bullish sentiment. I think silver price is going to go up over time. I think if you've seen how fast the silver market has risen, and you're looking to deploy money into the equities, trying to buy something cheap, taking some profits from the silver companies and trying to buy something that's cheap that might be on that next wave of metal price appreciation, to me is how I am playing it, and I think that people should consider playing it.
Well, Brian, some very cogent thoughts there. And before we move over into where some of the rotation could go, just another question on silver. You know, when we look back a year or two at how some of these companies were being valued, it was $1 an ounce in the ground, maybe $2 an ounce in the ground. Now we're actually seeing some companies with ounces in the ground, you know, blasting higher. One company we've talked about with you in the past, and I know that you've shared it on our show before, so I'm not giving away the secret sauce here, is Abra Silver. If you look at where it was valued last year compared to this year, or just the trajectory this year, clearly the ounces in the ground have been valued a lot higher. Now, they've had a lot of catalysts on the exploration side and on the key, you know, on milestones and different economic studies. But overall, when we look at Vizsla, when we look at other companies, they're getting closer to $4 to $5 an ounce in the ground now. So we are seeing quality get rewarded, but to your point, just because something has silver in its name doesn't mean that the management team or the jurisdiction or the dilution or the capital markets are quality. But with quality companies, they are finally getting rated higher. What do you make of that as far as are we closer to the end of where these things should be valued, or is there still room for these things to get valued at $10 an ounce in the ground or $15 an ounce in the ground?
Well, I think especially in a high sentiment environment, like a bull market environment, there's definitely room to go higher, I think, without a doubt. I think with a company like Ivory Silver, this year has sort of been a catch up. And I think it's probably solely based around Argentina, you know, the jurisdiction. The quality of Occulto is basically always been present in terms of size, grade, basically across the board. To me, it's always been like at or near the top of the world-class silver projects owned by a junior. And the thing holding it back was always what the future is going to hold for Argentina. And I think, you know, what we've seen in the second half of 2025 is the solidification of RIGI and how Abra is going to participate in that. And with Milei only getting stronger in was it September or October vote, whatever month that was in, I think that and the application basically being solidified, I think, you know, told the market, hey, look, we've got two more years where this thing should head to construction. They should basically be concrete in receiving all the benefits for RIGI, even if Milei doesn't win a second term. And not only this, but then you have the rise of East Occulto, where you've seen these gold grades that have been phenomenal. And while the critical mass is already there in what we knew with the Jack zone and the Occulto main zone, but you know, this, and I forget the drill results right off my head, but you know, those, what we've seen over the last couple of months has been phenomenal. And this is huge gravy on the cake. And we haven't even touched the porphyry systems here. And for me anyways, like with the strength of what Occulto is, what we see there, you know, the porphyries in this area, to me, it's not a matter if they're there. It's just what grade and probably what depth they're going to find them at. And that plays more into what that gravy is going to look like. And I think that puts them at the top of the M&A pyramid when it comes to actual silver companies out there. And I think the market is starting to recognize that. And so, you know, you have a positive sentiment in terms of the silver price. And I think that's going to continue moving forward. And when you have like a looking forward, a solidified future over the next 2 to 3 years, I think that puts Abra in a huge position to capitalize on a very bullish market.
Ryan, you're not alone in thinking that Abra is definitely on the table for some sort of M&A. It's impossible to predict the timing on that, but we've had other commentators also mention that. Just a question, though. Outside of Abra and Vizsla Silver, which both seem to be arguably world-class deposits, both are moving forward in the right direction, the silver space is much smaller than the gold space, and I think there's a lot of other companies that have silver resources but aren't nearly of the quality that Abra and Vizsla are. What do you see out there? Are there other arguably world-class deposits or assets that are being worked up, or is the silver space so small that we really just have a couple of them?
I think if you want to consider from a pure, and I'm not even sure it exists, like a really pure silver play, you know, maybe Vizsla is as close as it gets, or some of the deposits in Mexico, but most of them have, whether it's a gold component, you know, the probably the biggest one would be the Zed and lead connection. And again, it's not that I've ever even sort of tried or sought out that sort of company. It's, I just look for stories that are undervalued and, you know, almost regardless or agnostic to whatever the company is sort of looking for. I'll say, for instance, like I invested in a company called Group 11. This is back in the beginning of April. It was very fortuitous timing. And I looked at the drill results that they had, and it was a great, you know, zinc and lead hits that they had. And they sort of have a sprinkling of silver in there, but it was a very, you know, minuscule component of it. And I made the investment in the portfolio because of the quality of the management, because of the quality of the lead and zinc that I'd seen. But really what what I thought was interesting is they started hitting on these silver and copper hits below. And basically, the feeder system to this lead and zinc that we're seeing in the main mineralization that they've discovered was actually really interesting to me. And it was high grade. And I think that, you know, a company like Group 11 I think the critical mass is obviously going to be built on what they've already discovered. But stuff like the copper and the silver hit that they've hit and the percentage it's going to represent in the potential economics of a future mine, I think companies like that are going to start to garner more attention. They're not necessarily the pure play, but they're super high quality from my standpoint. And I think that's maybe where investors can look at stuff that isn't being recognized yet in this sort of silver euphoria. Group 11, you know, definitely doesn't market themselves as a silver company. Yet, if you look at their drill results, sort of where their discovery might be headed, I think there's going to be a significant silver component to it. And it won't be undershone if the silver price continues to go up.
Well, I think that's an interesting example to use. We've had Bart on the show before. Obviously, operating in Ireland, a lot of people may not be as familiar with that, but there is a mining history there. But in particular, Glencore is nearby. Glencore is a key stakeholder. And we've made the point on the show with other companies, Brian, love to get you to weigh in on this, about polymetallic deposits like this. Some of the biggest mines on the planet are polymetallic. Some of the mines that get acquired, you know, famously the Arizona Mining's Taylor deposit by South 32, very big price tag for that. And as, you know, zinc, lead, copper, silver, all mixed together. Those are some of the big mines, and that's what the big boys like. So, you know, I think you make a really interesting point about playing some of these metals through polymetallic deposits. Just like to get your thoughts on playing polymetallic deposits in general as a strategy.
Yeah, and again, I can't say that I was maybe necessarily smart enough to play it as a strategy. I was just looking at the quality of the company, and I'm fond of Bart. I have great respect for him and how he operates. And so that was sort of the basis. I think whenever you're looking at a polymetallic deposit, VMS or otherwise, I think metallurgy, mineral processing has to be at the top of your list. You have to talk about recoveries. You have to talk about the order of those recoveries, whether the recoveries that you're talking about represent an actual flow sheet, or whether these are just individual recoveries from the mineral. There's a lot of nuance when it comes to the polymetallic. And I think, you know, you bring up a good point that there could be a strategy to this, because the senior mining companies like these deposits if they work, because you have broad-based metal exposure. And, you know, when it sort of levels the playing field where you don't see too highs and you don't see too lows. And that sort of level playing field, when they can predict cost, they can predict profits, I think is what a lot of companies love to see, rather than this like whipsaw of metal prices, depending on, you know, what they're invested in and the quality of that deposit. So if you know, I was an investor and I hadn't invested in one of these, I think the first thing you want to look at and talk about with management is about metallurgy. From there, you know, you go into the basic economics. Once you know how much metal is actually recovered and which one is going to represent the economic significance, then you can sort of start working through the valuation for that company. A company like Group 11, you know, still very early in the discovery. As to my knowledge, I don't think that there's any met work that's historically or otherwise done on Ballywire. And so, you know, this is still something that needs to be answered. But in the meantime, you know, the grades and stuff that we're seeing in relation to other Irish deposits of the same ilk, things look really good. And I think they're going to stay focused on trying to make this thing bigger. And the news release that we had this week represents a huge step in that. They found another mineralized body. It looks like it might extend along the same trend, meaning that there's potential to double up on that mineralization and maybe even triple up. If you go with the news release from earlier this year, there was suggestion to think that there was even a third body projected. And so things start to get really big, really quick. And I think that's why you saw the reaction by the market. Bart did a really good job articulating exactly what gets broken down from this latest news release and the potential for the future. And again, like to me, that's where I'm focused first. But that metallurgy is going to have to be something that's answered. And in this case, you know, there's two different types of mineralization. You've got the massive sulfide mineralization, and then you've got sort of that feeder zone. And that's the stuff that's silver copper specific. And I'm not really sure on the risks or the difficulties in sort of processing that stuff. But that's a question that still needs to be answered.
Yeah, fair enough. It's still fairly early stage for Group 11, but hey, they're hitting with the drill bit and the market is rewarding them. That also ties into this whole copper discussion that, in all fairness, you've been chatting with us about this pretty much all year in terms of the opportunities in the copper space. And we've been agreeing with you in the fact that copper has been really stabilizing above $5. Now, there was that drop after the whole tariff, I guess, whatever that was. We can just call it the tariff issues. But when copper was climbing above $5, and then it dropped, and then it climbed back above $5, and now it's up over almost $5.40 right now as we're recording this. The stocks have also done very well, the majors at least. The juniors seem to have been lagging. This has been fitting the whole narrative, though, of what you've been sharing with us is some of these copper stocks are really the opportunity to be in. With copper now at one of the higher levels, at least it seems like sustainably for the year, has anything changed in your copper analysis when it comes to the equities?
No, I'm just as sort of bullish on the copper market as I have been the last couple of years. I think with this year in particular, I think things have changed with the advent of the Grasberg accident and what that sort of means moving ahead. And I think that's particularly why the copper price has risen. And I think this time it's actually going to stay. You know, we've seen pops in the copper price over the last couple of years. And I will say myself that I thought, okay, it's sort of in line with where I thought things were going to head, and just never held. And looking at earlier this year, I was looking to move profits from precious metals into something else. Not necessarily contrarian, but something that was cheap. And I thought copper fit the bill. And out of the, four or five picks I've made this year in the portfolio and the newsletter, three of those have been copper-based and the returns have been fantastic. And that was even sort of before the copper price has, you know, eclipsed and now stayed above $5 for a prolonged period of time now. So I personally think that copper is showing, despite what might be a weak economy, that the future for the copper price, the future for copper supply is sort of in question. And they're going to have to see higher copper prices to incentivize these developers, for these producers to bring more production online. And I think 2026 is going to be the year that copper really steps out and you know, shines just as much as probably the precious metals are, and maybe even to a different degree, again, in terms of size of the market, in terms of the juniors that are out there. There's definitely less quality copper companies than there is precious metal companies. So again, it's that much fewer to choose from. And so those quality deposits, those quality companies are going to go first. And you know, really have already started moving this year.
Well, Brian, you raise a great point there as far as the copper potentially shining big next year. We were just at some conferences where people from the stage were making the same point. You could make the point that last month, in the month of November, copper closed at an all-time monthly high, the highest level it ever has closed a month at, and so did the COPX, which is full of the copper producers. And when you look at a lot of individual copper producers, they're up near 52-week highs, so they've been doing great. To the point on the developers, a lot of them are up 100%, 200% this year. So people are picking up on the quality, and it's normal in a metal cycle for people to plow into the precious metals first and then start pulling profits and rotating. So as far as the rotation trade, you could see more of that next year. I guess as far as the drivers for a good development project, the problem is they take so long to build. They take so much money to build. How do you parse out what you think can actually have torque in a sector that has a 1 to 2 decade timeline?
Well, that's a good question. I think if you look at the companies that, let's take Surge. We've talked about Surge before. We've talked about Hot Chili before. I think both Hot Chili, even more so, Hot Chili sort of stands out to me because of how close they are to that construction decision. And they're still probably 2 years away from that. That gives you perspective on, like you're saying, on the timelines for these copper projects, especially when you're on the upper end, you know, those 100,000 ton type of projects. But that's also what sort of separates the wheat from the chaff. And that's maybe how investors, if you know, if you're looking for what company to invest in, what might have the most torque, I would say those ones that are you're looking for something that's obviously selling for less than it's worth, but then its proximity to production or the potential of production or construction is on the upper end, or like, let's say within the next 2 to 3 years. And it really narrows down the list of companies you can look at. A company like Surge, they're going to have a PFS completed in Q1 or just after Q1. And I think if things kind of work out the way that they could for Surge, you know, you could still be, you could still see something in 2 to 3 years, maybe four, depending on permitting. That would probably be the biggest thing that I would, in terms of timeline, be concerned about in BC. But, you know, those sorts of things can narrow it down for you. But again, I would start with something probably a little more simple, and I would start with price. Where can you find a good company that's got good management, that's running the company the right way, that's growing a resource, or that is doing the work in economic studies to sort of get it to that construction decision? And I think ultimately those sorts of companies are gonna see price appreciation. And while torque might be more associated with the timeline to construction, or maybe you have to take more risk and get into the exploration side of things, which I wouldn't necessarily think, or I would suggest that's for everybody, but certainly there would be lots of torque, but it comes with the higher risk. But there's going to be a lot of money that floods into copper. And so if you pick halfway decent on the companies that you invest in, I think you're going to do exceptionally well. And of course, you know, the valuations, I think, for a lot of these copper companies are looking great now. And while the obsession is on silver, it's probably still sort of around gold. You can probably get better deals in the copper space. And there's other metals too that show great valuations right now that, you know, might be next. And in what I think is going to be a market that sort of sees all these metal prices probably do well, despite the fact that the economy might not be great.
Brian, you made a comment there that we'll stick to the quality copper deposits. The problem that I think some investors have is that a lot of these copper deposits seem to look the same. Yes, there are some that are, again, kind of world-class that seem to be getting moved forward by companies that have unlimited amounts of money. But there's a lot of these copper deposits, small, large, medium size, all that come out with very similar economics. So what do you consider quality copper deposits? What do you look at?
Okay. So for me, there's simplicity. Again, like I'll use Surge as an example. It's a single pit, simple metallurgy, simple flow sheet. It's got the infrastructure around it. You know, there's the Huckleberry Mine, Imperial's Huckleberry Mine, which is closer to Otsa. But, you know, you've got all that infrastructure. And I think that might be the other separating factor, you know, just thinking about it more in terms of what the market is would give more torque or give more credence to, is something that's got the infrastructure in and around it. Something that doesn't require, you know, major roads to be built, these sorts of things that, again, that's tied to timeline, but, you know, the stuff where that's existing just stand out. Firefly Metals we made that pick in September. It's done exceptionally well. That's a past producing mine and in Ming that is, you know, ultra close. The only thing I would say that will delay a Firefly from going back into production is that they just want to keep pounding dollars into exploration and making Ming bigger and bigger and bigger. Otherwise, like those guys in terms of Canada, they might be the closest thing to a production story. All the infrastructure is already there, except for they are going to build a new mill. But that's a story I think that's going to stand out amongst the other ones because of that proximity and infrastructure being that huge one in terms of what the market looks at. You know, are these guys going to be able to go into production? And you could say 100% they will. Again, it's just when, and they seem to be in control of that. So other than that, again, the management team, these guys matter. When you start analyzing these guys, the more experience you have, who they're connected to, their ability to raise money. It's sort of synonymous across the sector of what makes a quality company. So I don't think I can shed too much light that people don't already or should already know about these junior mining companies. Proximity to construction, infrastructure. Of course, the more simplistic the deposit can be, I think the better. And then obviously size, that's another thing. If you're going to attract an M&A, if you're going to be an M&A target, you're probably going to have to be on that, definitely on the half a billion ton side, unless you're super high grade for these major mining companies to even look at you. And, you know, that's why I think when you look at a story like A-Mark, you know, with the Aurora discovery, yeah, I think it's pretty clear that Freeport's not going to be the one that consolidates that area. To me, it's probably going to be a gold company just because of how that deposit breaks down in terms of grade and that the focus on gold. Freeport wants huge, huge copper resources before they're going to sink any money into it, especially considering a place like the Tutagon that's going to require some infrastructure. And so again, that size would be right up there with that proximity to a construction decision in terms of, unless the management team's going to build it themselves, which is few and far between of manager teams that are qualified or able to do that. So the M&A angle is probably going to have to be something that you look at, and you'll definitely need size there.
Well, Brian, just to follow up on that, it brings up a great point that most juniors do not have the skill sets or the team or the experience to build copper mines. They are way bigger than even building a gold mine or a silver mine. So they take a special skill set. And there's a lot of companies, like, you know, you mentioned Surge, that has a strategic in there with ARM. And there's a lot of copper companies that have Rio Tinto in there, BHP in there, you know. So, and now, even to your point, a lot of gold companies are now becoming strategics because they want to become a copper gold company. How important is it that a project gets vetted and has the buy-in from a strategic? Because the odds are they're not going to build it on their own. How important is it to have that joint venture or that maybe even multiple partners in there that have vetted the company first as an investor that gives you the confidence that one of the big boys has already given it the thumbs up?
Yeah, like it's one of those things that can be huge. You know, I think I would just caution investors to do some research and to see why that strategic has, or like how they acquired or when they acquired that strategic position. Excuse me. Some of those things are inherited. Some of those positions are meaningless. I think if you saw a BHP invest in a copper developer tomorrow, I would say that that's a pretty good sign that they're very interested and that deposit is legit. And again, you go down that list of those senior producers, if they took, like, if we're talking the next month or so, or like any time this year, that would be a huge positive and I think legitimizing move to watch for. And so that can be something for, especially for investors that may have some trepidation into getting to the copper market if they're not familiar with it. That can be a way to sort of break it down. But if we're talking about relationships with these developers that goes back, let's say, more than a couple years, a few years, and you don't fully understand that relationship, I would just have some caution to understanding whether that's still a priority for the senior company. Like I said, with the amount of mergers and acquisitions, with the amount of management changes, you know, things change in the priority list and stuff can get lost. And so a strategic position isn't always a legitimizing factor. You just need to find out why and when. And usually that'll point you towards, you know, what's kind of really going on and what the future might hold. The other side to that is just because a developer doesn't have a strategic doesn't mean that it's not legit. I just think it probably makes it harder for a lot of newbie investors, especially, to sort of weed through maybe what makes a quality deposit or quality project. And that might be where the trepidation is. But, you know, if you're going to use that as a point to validate companies, just make sure you understand exactly how that relationship or strategic position was taken, because the junior is always going to sell it like it's a legitimizing factor. So just be cautious.
Such a good comment there, Brian. It's always questions you need to ask. When they came in, how they've kept their position up to speed. All of these things need to be considered with these sort of positions. And yeah, obviously, anytime a company comes in now, it's a good sign. But yeah, just be sure you do your research on that kind of stuff. All right, Brian, we're out of time here, but always fascinating chatting with you. Thank you, as always, for your time, for everyone listening on the weekend show. Be sure to check out Brian's website. It's the Junior Stock Review. I'll post a link in the show notes to that. And Brian will chat with you in the new year. So thanks for joining us on this weekend show. Have a great rest of your year. Happy New Year. And everyone, stick around. We are going to be right back.
Thanks for having me, Corey.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.